Well, it's very nice to be here for Bill's celebration. I have to confess I didn't learn hot spicification from Bill, but I did learn it from Ian Stewart, who probably learned it from you, Marcy, who learned it from Bill, so it's not too far away. And another thing I learned indirectly from Bill is that if you look at mode interactions, so K-dimension 2 bifurcations, then you often get more than the sum of the parts. And this is comes up in this work here, which is joint work with Stella Abreu from Porto and Philip Aston from Seoul. So one thing I'm worried about is that at some point during this talk, Bill will stand up and say that sometime in 1900 and something he worked on this mode interaction. So I'm going to look at a very simple, or very simple looking bifurcation. It's two steady state bifurcations combining. It's co-dimension 2. There's square symmetry, D4 symmetry, and the two families of zero eigenvalues are from different representations, so there's no non-semisimplicity. It's not Talbot-Bogdanoff or anything like that. It's a three-dimensional center manifold. So it's about the simplest situation that anything difficult could happen, might happen. And we found, somewhat to our surprise, that there's quite interesting things here. Secondary bifurcations to periodic solutions, symmetric chaos in there, symmetry increasing bifurcations, lots of other stuff. And because it's steady state, it's not due to normal form effects. Some of that's not so surprising. There's lots of work in the literature, Guggenheim and Warfork and other people that are down there, where it's well known that in co-dimension 2 bifurcations, even without normal form effects, you get chaotic dynamics. So I think the things that are new in this, the things that I hope are new, is the symmetric chaos and the symmetry increasing bifurcations. So symmetric these things were introduced in a paper by Shastan Golubitsky in the, I think in 1988. But that was in the context of global bifurcation theory, and as far as we know, this is the first time these things have been seen in a local bifurcation. So here's the mode interaction. First of all, we've got standard irreducible representation of D4 and R2. So we've got the rotations and the reflection. And it's coupled with a one-dimensional representation where the Z4 is acting trivially, and you just have the reflections send W onto minus W. So I'm using the XY coordinates for the standard representation and W for the one-dimensional representation. You combine the two things together, and that's the three-dimensional center manifold symmetry. So we wrote down the vector field at some truncated order, and the first thing that's kind of interesting about this example is that there's lots of different orders of homogeneity. As well as linear terms and cubic terms, there's also a quadratic term up over there and a fourth-order term over here, and it turns out that they're all crucial for the dynamics. So there's two bifurcation parameters, lambda and mu, and then these four Taylor coefficients that are all different orders of homogeneity. If you're interested just in steady states, then you can equilibria, it turns out, are truncated at cubic order. And you can even set d equals 0. So you get a much simpler set of equations. And maybe I'll use this as an advertisement for the work of recent work of Castro and Duplessis, which seems to give new hope to the idea that singularity theory might be useful in problems with symmetry. If you tried doing singularity theory on this vector field using existing techniques, the calculations get out of hand very quickly. But the new methods mean at least if you just want to restrict the equilibria, maybe there's hope after all. But in this talk, I'm definitely interested in bifurcations other than equilibria. So starting off with equilibria, there's a lattice of isotropy subgroups, and there's three axial subgroups, one-dimensional fixed-point spaces, which I've labeled Z4, that's just the rotations in the square, and then there's two element groups, D1E and D1V. So they both contain one reflection as a non-trivial symmetry. The E stands for the reflection that joins the edges of a square, and the V stands for vertices of a square. So they're kind of non-conjugate solutions, and as I say, they've all got one-dimensional fixed-point spaces. And then you've got the equivalent branching lemma, which says that you do get branches of equilibria with those three symmetry types. And then the question is, what else happens? So I'm pleased to say that Bill hasn't stood up yet and said that he did this stuff, but I'll stand up for him. Back in 1999, Bill did work on this problem, and there wrote a paper where they pointed out that for representation theoretic reasons, the secondary bifurcation from the Z4 equilibria was a Hopf bifurcation, because Z4 only has complex irreducibles, so that's kind of all that can happen. And then the exponent Hopf theorem basically says, in this case, it's just by uniqueness, it tells you that the bifurcating periodic solutions have trivial symmetry spatially, but they have the Z4 symmetry still as a spatio-temporal symmetry. And all of this is easy to calculate. So you can calculate the secondary bifurcation point, and you can compute whether the branch is stable and whether it bifurcates supercritically. So that's all okay. And then you can look at the next branch of primary equilibria is the D1 edge. And then it turns out that you can't apply representation theoretic ideas. You can't, without doing a calculation, you don't know what's going to happen. But it turns out you can get secondary bifurcations to steady state Hopf bifurcations depending on the values of the Taylor coefficients. And again, you get spatio-temporal symmetry. And again, you can do everything analytically, but the calculations are, at this point, get pretty dreadful, but you can, so you can do them. And that's as far as you, I should say D1B gets the same stuff, but I'm not going to worry about that so much in this talk. So far we have the situation of the primary and secondary bifurcations is we get branches of equilibria, we can choose the parameters so that Z4 and D1E are initially asymptotically stable. I'm not going to worry about D1V so much. And then we get secondary Hopf bifurcations to Z4, and we can also choose the parameters so that we get D1E periodic solutions, and that they're asymptotically stable. And then the question is, what else happens? So at this point, let's just draw a picture of where we are so far. So the classical picture that I have in my mind when I think of a mode interaction is in volume one of Golubitsky and Schaefer, where it was just Z2 squared symmetry, where you get this kind of picture. So you have two primary branches, and they're joined by some asymptotically stable mixed mode solution. And there's lots of other things that can happen, but this is the kind of the soft way of going without jump from one primary branch to the other primary branch via secondary bifurcation. And the first point is that this is not what's happening in... can I keep this? Yeah, that worked. So this can't be happening in this example because we have the following situation. There's our D4 equilibria that was the trivial solution, and we've got maybe this primary bifurcation to Z4, periodic Z4 equilibria. We've also got the secondary branch here, which maybe restabilizes to D1 edge, and we've got this these two Hopf bifurcations over here to periodic solutions, but this kind of has a what I might call a Z4 tilde symmetry, a spatio-temporal symmetry that's Z4, and this has some kind of spatio-temporal D1E symmetry. And the point is, these are different symmetry types, so they can't coalesce. So the question is, what happens? What kind of happens in here? Is there some soft version of going from one primary branch to the other primary branch that kind of fills in this gap? And that's where the chaotic dynamics came in. So we used auto, the author's here, to look at how the Z4 periodic solutions, what happens at the end of the Z4 periodic solutions, and we found that it was just a saddle node bifurcation, and they just lost stability, just the turning point. And then we used DS Tool by John Guggenheim and co-workers, and found, somewhat to our surprise, that there was just an explosion to a D4 symmetric attractor. So completely non-hysteretic. So if I jump forward, I've got a picture of that. Oh, here we are, bent too far forward. So these are pictures of the secondary periodic solution. So this is the XY plane, this is the XW plane, and you can see the D1 edge. They just have a twofold spatio-temporal symmetry, and here's a Z4 periodic solution with a fourfold spatio-temporal symmetry. And if you change the parameter slightly from the Z4 periodic solution, Z4 periodic, you get the D4 chaotic attractor again in XY and XW. And so It's certainly not the kind of weak chaos that you often see in local codimension bifurcations. It's really full-scale chaos. It's not just thickening some periodic solution, making it quasi-periodic, and then you wonder, is it quasi-periodic or chaotic? It's clearly full-scale chaos in this three-dimensional center manifold. Also, we superimposed all the D1 and Z4 periodic solutions and their conjugates, and you can kind of see that these are clearly linked up with these. It's not just jumping off into some different part of phase space. It's all part of the picture. Yeah. I'll get to that later on. that is a problem, but hopefully I can convince you that they are symmetric. Let's see. Okay, so that's where we were. This is the DS tool told us this, and then we got the question of convincing yourself that it really is a chaotic attractor that's symmetric. We didn't follow it. From our point of view, it just does this. And sketch on your picture, but I guess where you wear these. Oh, sorry, it's over here. Yes, except you can't actually tie up because you're going into the wrong symmetry type. But, yeah. Yes, I think the thing is just exploding here. So I don't think it matters terribly where this goes. It's just the fact that this has hit its boundary or whatever. Yeah. So, anyway, we kind of feel that we actually understand this transition reasonably well because, as I said, there's no hysteresis. You vary the parameters backwards and you get the transition back to the periodic solution exactly the same place. This one from the D1 solution turns out to be a lot more complicated. First of all, I've got a bad typo here. I've written non-symmetric equilibria. It should be non-symmetric periodic solutions. So what happens is the periodic solutions with the spatio-temporal symmetry just lose stability via a subcritical pitchfork bifurcation to non-symmetric periodic solutions of roughly the same period. So it's not a period doubling bifurcation. It's one of these examples of suppression of period doubling. And then we get unstable non-symmetric periodic solution. And then you can, still using auto, we can see that the non-symmetric equilibria regain stability at a turning point. Now you have asymptotically stable non-symmetric, again, periodic solutions. And then using auto, we were also able to compute the first period doubling bifurcation. And using DS tool, we saw that there was a now sequence of period doubling bifurcations from this non-symmetric periodic solution. And then it gets extremely complicated. So using DS tool again, we see all kinds of complicated transitions between things that are non-symmetric, but now also the D1 vertex symmetry that we hadn't mentioned so far, and they can be periodic solutions or chaotic solutions. And eventually, you find a regime where the chaotic ones dominate, and then they undergo a clear symmetry increasing bifurcation from the D1 chaos to the D4 chaos. So we now get to the issue of how can we convince ourselves that these things really are chaotic, and you also get the question of is this part of the local bifurcation, or is it just some kind of, are we just choosing the parameters too large? So using computing maximal Lyapunov exponents, we could automate this quite easily, and we find that here we have the Z4 equilibria, Hopf bifurcation to Z4 periodic. Using auto, there's a curve around here, which unfortunately I haven't shown, which is the the saddle node bifurcation where it loses stability, and then the Lyapunov exponents immediately become positive along that curve. And then it's kind of messier on the other side before it becomes D1 periodic and the D1 equilibria. And this is a 100 by 100 grid, and we're able to capture quite a bit of this curve, and increase the resolution in this region. So that's the finer grid of lambdas and mu's here, and you can see that the curve really does, it's pretty clear the curve does go into the origin. So the chaotic dynamics is part of the local bifurcation picture, and it's not exponentially small. And then we use the symmetry detective method of So this is originally by Brainy, Donitz, and Golubitsky came up with a method for automating the computation of symmetries of attractors. The idea was to convert computing a symmetry of an attractor to computing symmetry of a point. And there's a lot of detail on this picture you can't see, but the red is now D4 symmetric chaotic attractors. The green is the D1 vertex symmetric attractors, and black is non-symmetric, and blue is D1H. And I magnified the top right corner of this, and you can see a bit more clearly here. I've also marked chaotic is solid, and non-chaotic is sort of clear. So this over here is a D1 vertex symmetric chaotic attractor, and here it's a D1 vertex periodic attractor. You can see there's also non-symmetric chaos and non-symmetric periodic. There's the occasional odd thing, like a D1 edge symmetric chaotic attractor over there, and the odd gap up there, which can all be verified using DS tool. And as far as you can tell, this is an accurate picture of what's going on. Now I'm going to get to Jeroen's question. Yeah, so we were very disturbed by this picture. It's because it's supposed to be D4 symmetric, but clearly it's not. And part of the problem is that we had to take, to plot this picture, we had to take a time step of 0.01, or otherwise the curves become very jagged. And then we didn't want to ruin the memory, so there's only 200,000 data points here. So actually you're integrating for time 2,000. So it hadn't had really enough time to go around much of the chaotic attractor. So this is counting pixels. We just count a pixel if it's here any time, and then it's red, and otherwise it's not. And this is now a 100 million data points. And even now, you really could tell me that, hang on, this is not symmetric, because we've got this bit down here and not over there. So this is kind of unfortunate. In fact, it seems pretty impossible to actually get the D4 symmetric thing, because we just can't integrate long enough. And this is also a problem using DS tool, and that's part of the reason why we had to use the symmetry detectives to get a convincing picture. But I've done a couple of things to try and show this is symmetric. So first of all, I've accidentally made a video here, just using the fact that the thing doesn't come up immediately. So I can do that again. So you can see that the high order bits get hit kind of very symmetrically. Once more, okay. So if you look in the middle, you can see it's symmetric, okay? So that's not so good. You can also make this not a video. And okay, so this is again the same picture, which is not symmetric, and so this, I spent hours, you can imagine, choosing the colours here. They're definitely not trying to compete with Mike and Marty on the coffee table books. So, but this is colouring by how many times each pixel is hit. And now you can see that apart from this black stuff on the outside, everything that gets hit more than 10 times actually does get hit perfectly symmetrically. So, wrong button again. So these are the ones that get hit over 100,000 times. And that is perfectly symmetric if you... yes, it is. See, you want to say that's two and that's one?
Yeah.
That's the. I would say this is. I would say that's two pixels there. if you plot this picture and then overlay it by swapping x and y over, yeah, or by sending y to minus y or x to minus x, it overlays exactly. So.
If you could show that the symmetric
Sure, yeah. we haven't done anything in three dimensions. We're just looking at the three-dimensional projection. Yeah, you have to take my word for it. This actually is the metric if you overlay it, whereas the first picture clearly wasn't. And thank you. Right. So, and then the next layer of 10,000 also turns out, I think, to be perfectly symmetric. And you have to get to the ones that aren't hit very much. Even at this level, I think it works out fine. And this one, probably not. Okay, I think I'd admit that one's slightly out of filter. If anyone has any ideas how to do this better, well, Monty just suggested one about showing the attraction in three dimensions actually intersects itself. It's actually quite a problem. And I'd like to mention one other thing, is that I mentioned there were two papers on detectives. I suspect that the first one of Berenyi et al. Might have more problems, because one of these pixels here is just as important as a pixel up there. Whereas when you do the second paper by Dionysio Gordievsky and Nickel used the ergodic theorem and doing time averages, and then a pixel that's hit several times is much more important than a pixel that's hit one time. And we certainly found that when we use the symmetry detective method, we don't seem to have any anomalies. You may have to wait a very long time to see the symmetric attractor, but you don't get the wrong answer if you wait long enough. So I suspect that the method's working pretty well. Do I have anything else to say? There's a D1 vertex symmetric attractor. And you can see it has the same problem, that this is not exactly symmetric, but it's the black bits that aren't matching up right, the things that only hit a few times. So I'm convinced these are not everyone is. You would say that you don't. Sorry, you say. Okay. Great. So. Okay. Thanks. Well, that's good. I could easily show something more to it. Right. Anyway, this is one last picture of some of the other kinds of things that are very close to these D1 vertex symmetric attractors. I want to end this talk, just since I've got a few minutes, just by explaining why on earth we were looking at this problem, because we certainly didn't expect to find symmetric chaos, and there's not actually a whole lot of point for talking about this example without it there, so there must have been a reason. So this is when I was back in Houston and talking with Martin. We were kind of interested in the flame experiments of Michael Gorman, where he gets situations like this, where you have different kinds of periodic solutions, and you have something that kind of had a threefold spatiotemporal symmetry here and a fourfold spatiotemporal symmetry there. And then you see this thing called a hopping mode that he claims was some kind of interaction of the two. And people try to explain this by trying to draw that picture. Now, there's a reason for doing that. There was actually circular symmetry in the problem. And so in the circular symmetric thing, some of these things became rotating waves, and these things were quasi-periodic. And they had no spatial symmetry. And from the point of view of symmetry on average, they actually had SO2 symmetry. So from a certain point of view, you could imagine that this thing could join up with that thing. But Martin Cooper taught us that if you want to understand this codimension 2 bifurcation, you go to the rotating frame, and then you get a picture that just looks like this, where this has a discrete spatiotemporal symmetry, this has a discrete spatiotemporal symmetry, and they can't possibly join up. There has to be a tertiary bifurcation in the middle. And I think what I was trying to get Stella to do when she came to Surrey was to compute this tertiary bifurcation of non-symmetric periodic solutions. And then we were going to try to see how this matched up with hopping modes and also push-me-pull-you modes that come up in Werner Mikowski's work. And it turns out the whole thing is much more complicated. And I suspect that in lots of applications, there are probably lots of examples of things with square symmetry and cellular structures in circular symmetry. And you'd expect to see this kind of full-scale chaotic dynamics all over the place, I would guess, so if you're looking for it. So that's where I'll stop.